I call this meeting on House Military Veterans Affairs Committee to order. It's 1:02 p.m. Tuesday, February 13th. We're in the Gruenberg Room at the Capitol in Juneau. Present with me, I have Representative Groh, Representative Rauscher, Representative Sadler, and myself, Chair Wright, and also Representative Gray. Let the record reflect, we have a quorum to conduct business. First off, I'd like to thank Ms. Talia Ames with the Juneau LIO for moderating today's meeting. And I also like to thank Kevin Allen with the House Records for documenting today's meeting. We have two items on the agenda today. First is HB 158, Military United States Space Force. This is our second hearing on the bill. My office has received no amendments, so the bill will be before the committee. We do need to do a public testimony on the bill, so I will open the public testimony now. Is there anyone on the line for public testimony? Anyone in the room who would like to publicly testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Are there any further questions from the committee for the bill sponsor? We also have Tammy Farrell online from the Department of Defense, as well as to brief a recap for 158, if necessary. Does anyone need a brief? Nope. Perfect. Seeing.
Chairman, I do a question.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Perot. Just curious, having been a member of the Association of the U.S. Army, the Air Force Association, but not kept up as much as I should have, how prevalent is the expansion of the Air Force Association to include the Special Space Forces? Is that something that happened at a national level, or is that state by state? Just a little bit of information about that, please.
Let the record reflect. Representative Carpenter has joined us. Ms. Perot, did you hear that question?
Chair Wright, to Representative Sadler, thank you very much for the question. I believe your question is addressing what is the expansion of the Space Force Association. So this is a military service organization, a supporting organization for the United States Space Force. Has that expanded and has that military support organization been established at the national level? My understanding, I am not an expert on all military service organizations, is the Space Force Association is established as a separate organization from the Air Force Association and the Army Association, and they are working on establishing those organizations in the states at this time. I do not have any further details and would be happy to follow up with Representative Sadler.
This is a follow-up.
Thank you. Actually, a follow-up for the chair. Given at the top of page 2, line 1, it implies by the additional language in the bill now that the Air and Space Forces Association is one entity. We might be able to change that either by making splitting up B into B and C or simply having the Air and Space Forces Associations. But if indeed, as Ms. Perot says, they're separate associations, we might want to specify that. Now, if you're willing to entertain that motion at the appropriate time, I'd like to make it.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir. But at this time, well, Mr. Chairman, I propose a conceptual amendment to House Bill 158, that being on page 2, line 1, that we essentially divide subparagraph B, which now says the Air and Space Forces Association, to do two separate paragraphs, being the Air Force Association and the second one being the Space Forces Association, and authorize any conforming amendments necessary.
Any objection?
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To address any, just for discussion, I think, again, having been a member of the Air Force Association and the Association of the U.S. Army, I know that they are similar in being support organizations for their services. The integration of the new Space Force into the entire DoD infrastructure looks like it's happening at this level now. So I just think it would be appropriate if we're calling out the Marine Corps Association, the Navy League, the Association Army, that we should have separate and equal lines for the Air Force Association and for the Space Forces Association.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to ask the people online there what they think of the idea.
Ms. Perot, are you still on the line?
Chairman Wright, yes. I believe the question from Representative Rauscher was, what is the opinion of the Department of Defense on expanding the language within the statute to include the Space Force Association? I defer to the state on how they would want to do that. It does appear that the Space Force Association as a national organization would be appropriately recognized as the statute intends.
Thank you, Ms. Perot.
Do we have anybody from the state that could answer the question besides the seven of us?
We do not. Brief for these. Representative Sadler?
Chairman, I withdraw my motion at this time.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. This time we will hold this bill for a future date. Moving on. Next up, we have HB 228, Mental Health Psychedelic Med Task Force from Rep. Armstrong. Now, this is our first hearing on the bill. Please, Rep. Armstrong, please approach the bench and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. So we'd like to first invite Representative Armstrong to use a brief introduction, and then we will adopt the CS as our working document and proceed with the rest of the presentation.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you, Chair Wright. I am Rep. Armstrong for the record, and with me today is
Calvin Zulo, staff to Representative Armstrong.
Very, very brief introduction before we get into the presentation. House Bill 228, which sounds quite provocative, I think you will find is actually a pretty staid bill. We are asking to convene a task force to make policy recommendations to the next legislature in advance of the FDA medicalizing certain psychedelic medicines. So we are not taking a position on decriminalization or medicalization, asking the state or the task force to do that. It has more to do with licensing and regulation. These are decisions the state would have to make anyway. But as you'll see, because of the outsized impact these medicines can have on our state, and because I think it can save the state money to bring a group of experts together to do this in advance, we think a task force is necessary.
Here for these. Thank you, Representative Armstrong. Next, we will adopt the committee substitute as our working document. Rep. Rauscher, do you have a motion?
Chairman Wright, I move that the committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 228, Work Order 33-LS0976/Y as our working document.
Object for the purpose of discussion.
Representative Armstrong, staff, Calvin. Calvin, will you go over the changes to the previous version?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Calvin Zulo, staff to Representative Armstrong. And then these are the summary of changes from the previous version of /R. The first change in section 1A, after the purpose of the task force is to, new language is added that reads, prepare for the potential medicalization of psychedelic medicines by the United States Food and Drug Administration to make policy recommendations to the Alaska State Legislature concerning insurance and licensure, given the unique nature of the administration of psychedelic medicines, and to ensure the state is prepared if psychedelic medicines become available for prescription. This change clarifies the purpose of the task force is only to ensure the state is prepared if this federal government authorizes prescriptions of psychedelic medicines, and not to advocate for or against the medicalization of psychedelics. The second change, in section 1A4, the existing language, which reads, consider legal and regulatory pathways to the legalization of psychedelic medicines in the state and the potential effects of medicines on public health, is replaced with language that reads, consider legal and regulatory changes that could be necessary in the state after federal medical approval of psychedelic medicines. This change is also made to clarify the purpose and the work of the task force. The third change, in Section 1B5, the language, one of whom must be a recognized ethno-herbalist, is deleted. This change is made to give the Alaska Native Health Board more latitude to choose their representatives to the task force. The fourth change, a new subsection is added as 1B8, and the following subsections are renumbered. The new subsection 1B8 reads, one member representing licensed therapists or counselors appointed by the Board of Directors of the Alaska Addiction Professionals Association. This change recognizes that therapists or counselors would be involved in the administration of psychedelic medicines and adds a representative from that field to the task force. The fifth change, in Section 1E, the language, but are entitled to per diem and travel expenses authorized for boards and commissions under Alaska Statute 3920-180, is deleted. This change removes state funding for board travel. The sixth change, Section 1F2, which instructs the task force to ensure members are available for legislative hearings, is deleted, as the task force will terminate before the next legislative session. And the seventh and final change, Section 1G is reworded to clarify the termination date of the task force is when the 34th Alaska Legislature convenes in January 2025, not when the 35th Alaska Legislature convenes in January 2027. This change aligns with the existing task force report due date of December 31st, 2024. That's all of the changes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Calvin. Representative Carpenter, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Hearing no further objections, Version Y is before the committee. Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor? Sure. Representative Sadler?
Chair, I would probably have some questions arise after the presentation, so if I can hold over the chance to ask the sponsor questions after the presentation, I'm sure I'll have some.
Would you like to proceed with your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I mentioned today, we are going to be looking at House Bill 228, Alaska Mental Health and Psychedelic Medicine Task Force. Have to have the big disclaimer one more time that this task force has not been designed to consider or take a position on the medicalization, decriminalization, or legalization of psychedelic medicines. The purpose of this task force is to craft a set of policy recommendations that would be delivered by the end of this year for the 34th legislature. As I'll get into later, it is highly, highly likely that the FDA will begin approvals this August, make approvals of the first psychedelic medicine. And the FDA approves drugs all the time, but these types of medicines require a lot more thoughtfulness. One example of the way that the healthcare industry or people are preparing for this is last May, the American Medical Association approved what's called a CPT. It's a current procedural terminology code. These types of codes are required if you want to be able to offer some kind of therapy or medicine and get insurance coverage and reimbursement. And so that's one of a lot of small ways that I think a lot of us don't have that highly detailed expertise when it comes to medical codes and licensing and insurance and everything that goes into that. And so when we were looking into this and preparing for it, we realized that a task force would be best set up to bring those experts together. And we also thought it would be best to be proactive to make sure that we can maximize the benefits for our state. To be clear, what we're asking this task force to do would be exactly what the state will be required to do beginning this year because of the approval of these medicines. We're just trying to do it in the best way possible. And as I mentioned, I would posit that this would save the state money and time because we'd be bringing together a group of folks who would be bringing all their expertise to make that best set of policy recommendations for us. So there are four things that they are set to do. The really key thing I want to draw your attention to and what it comes down to is consider and recommend those licensing and insurance requirements. So for example, with licensing, if you're curious what that might be, in the current FDA guidance, there are six different professional credentials of the types of people who can facilitate psychedelic medicines. These are not where you get prescribed and go home and take it. They're taken in a controlled setting under a prescribed setting. And then there's what's called a secondary monitor who is also there. And it's kind of broad. It's someone with a bachelor's and 1 year of clinical experience in a healthcare setting. And this task force could perhaps think about what cultural considerations do we need to take into play? Who is best suited to do that type of work and to be present to make sure that this is both safe and accessible. Same with insurance. So many of us probably have been or know someone who's been impacted positively by having great insurance caps, being able to afford insulin, medicine for cancer treatment, any number of things all exist and become affordable because of considering insurance cost. And so that's the other piece of this is a life-changing medicine for so many people, and we want to make sure that as many people as possible have access to it. And then this fourth one here, considering legal and regulatory changes, that kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier with that American Medical Association example. There are so many things that we don't know what we don't know that we want this task force to look into, because the approval of this could conflict with other existing things in our statutes. So, and then just a quick update on kind of where other states are at. So several states have these task force have been established. Many of them have already established and put out those reports, including Utah, Hawaii, Washington, Oregon, Connecticut, Nevada, tons of them. But a couple of interesting things is that in 2021, Texas became the first state to enact a psychedelic research bill with political support from Governor Rick Perry. The state itself is actually funding a trial that will administer psilocybin to veterans with PTSD at Baylor College and at the VA Center in Houston. Pennsylvania has also introduced a similar bill. So some states are taking on, you know, in the case of Texas, they are actually using state money to fund psychedelic research for veterans. And other states have looked into decriminalization. Other states like Oregon have actually legalized these medicines ahead. What we're, you know, proposing here is basically the most conservative thing. The policy recommendations that would be brought forth would only be enacted if and when the FDA, you know, approves these medicines for prescription. So as I mentioned, why this is important, the FDA approves drugs all the time. But as you can see from this quote, there has probably never been a drug that is coming out that has gotten as much enthusiasm and anticipation as these different psychedelic compounds have. I think many of you here know this. I won't beat the drum on it, but we in Alaska, we have one of the chance. This medicine has the chance to have an outsized impact in our state due to the fact that we have some of the worst rates of mental health issues, addiction, violence, and of course, we have the most number of veterans per capita. So we are poised to be a state where a large number of our citizens could be potential candidates for this type of therapy. So Alaska, as I said, has the largest share of veterans per capita. I just wanted to touch on a few statistics and where the VA is at with their work on this right now. So veterans have a 57% higher suicide rate than non-veterans. More than 30,000 service members have taken their own lives since 9/11, which is four times the number who have died on the battlefield. Two of 10 who have PTSD also suffer from substance use disorder. Forgive me for that typo there. The bottom line here is several veterans and returning veterans have so many issues with PTSD, depression, anxiety, and substance use disorder. And those are the exact things that psychedelic medicines target, which is why the VA has taken a special interest in this. The VA started offering psychedelic substances to patients as part of clinical trials in 2022. And there are now several studies at VA facilities across the U.S. that are researching psychedelic assisted therapy for mental health. And the department is also closely monitoring outside research. In 2023, it was pretty groundbreaking. There was a hearing in the U.S. House Veterans Affairs Subcommittee on Health, and it was the first one of its kind that was focused on psychedelic assisted therapy for veterans' mental health. I will say veterans have been at the forefront of talking about this, bringing it into our awareness and championing this type of work. So it's something that we thought the community would be especially interested in. And yeah, I thought that this was an especially poignant quote from a veteran who underwent psychedelic treatment. If I hadn't gone through it, my son would have a folded flag. And instead, he has a father. I think we need more mothers and more fathers and less folded flags. Going to go through a little bit of the timeline here. And you'll see at the bottom left, there is a clinical trials map. There are about 26 pages of current trials that are underway across the U.S. So I touched on the ones at VA facilities, but there are several, you know, and Texas is undertaking them at a VA facility in Baylor. There are a lot of trials happening for a number of compounds and that are all in a different state. This is a very high level of some key dates. So in 2017, the FDA designated MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD as a breakthrough therapy. And there was one other. They also did two breakthrough therapy designations for psilocybin for both treatment-resistant depression and major depressive disorder. Those clinical trials that I mentioned that have been underway, and the one for the medicine that will be coming up for possible approval in August has been 20 years of clinical trials. So these are not things that happen overnight. It's something that's been going on for a long time. So in addition to PTSD and depressive disorder, the other conditions that these are being studied in clinical trials are therapeutic value for cancer-related anxiety, anorexia, substance use disorders, and various types of chronic pain. So in 2021, MAPS, which is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, They conducted their two phase three clinical trials for MDMA therapy, of course, under the guidance and overseen by the FDA. They showed that patients had clinically significant improvements in PTSD symptoms, and 71.2% of participants receiving MDMA therapy no longer met the diagnostic criteria for PTSD at the end of the study. So something I'm going to kind of pause and go off script on is that PTSD and depression, if you've had it or know someone who has it, is completely debilitating. And to date, the only treatment that we have is talk therapy, antidepressants, and sometimes there's like off-label use of medicines like prazosin, which they give if you have night terrors, and that's an anti-hyperintensive. It has been something where once you have it, your brain is rewired. Your brain mass actually changes when you go through a traumatic event, and there's never been a path forward to undo that. And that's why so many folks who suffer with this, you see these incredibly high rates of suicide because it literally becomes unbearable. So when we say 71.2% of people in this trial no longer met the criteria, that is astonishing. There's just never been anything like this, and it's why so many folks are so excited and why we want to make sure that we are ready and able to get this in the hands of as many people as possible. And as I mentioned, so MAPS has been around for 38 years. They were established 38 years ago to start looking into psychedelic therapies. And they have spent 20 years collecting clinical trial data. And so many of these other clinical trials still have a long way to go. There are a couple in phase three and a couple in phase two. So, okay, coming back to it, in December 2023, MAPS formally submitted what is called a new drug application to the FDA. So this was just probably 2 months ago today, actually. And if it is approved, it will be the first new FDA-approved PTSD treatment in more than 20 years. Just a few days ago, the FDA accepted the application from MAPS and gave it priority review, and they are expected to announce its determination in August 2024. So we will know as soon as this August if the FDA will be approving this first medicine, which is MDMA. And then, as I mentioned, there are other psilocybin and other forms of MDMA are in different stages with their trials, and it's highly likely that more will follow in the next year or two. Let me see.
Take a brief pause for some questions.
Of course.
Anyone have any questions from the committee? Representative Rosser?
Yep. Thank you. Through the chair, I was wondering, you have 72% of the participants receiving out of how many?
That's a good question. I think that MAPS has had about 1,700 people go through their trials for this particular trial, but I can get back to you on the exact number for this trial.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair, we have lots of new psychiatric medications being approved all the time. Why do we need a task force for this psychiatric medication and not for others?
Yeah, thank you so much for that question, Representative Gray, through the chair. So what makes this medicine really different from other medicines is that you don't just get it prescribed and go home. So the way that, for example, the MDMA therapy that I'm going to kind of focus on here, because that is the one that would be approved in August, is you take the MDMA three times over three different eight-hour therapy sessions with a therapist and a secondary monitor, and then you're doing 12 drug-free therapy sessions. So you don't take this medicine and go home. You're in a very prescribed setting. The other thing is that the kind of prescription for this is going to be really unique because it's not just taking a certain dose. Part of these trials and the recommendations is the set and setting. So for folks out there who are listening, if you're like, wow, I've taken MDMA at a party or magic mushrooms at a party, which you shouldn't, it's illegal. But if you have, I'm just saying, I'm not advocating for that on the record. But if you have, you're like, and I still get depressed sometimes, it's because the set and setting and the work that you do with the therapist is so crucial to the process. And so the reason we need a task force is because you can imagine the licensing piece is really important. Different populations and groups respond differently to certain types of therapy. There's a lot of trauma-informed care that needs to go into it. So thinking about who's in that room, your brain is so malleable and your aperture is wide open, and who we are going to hand the keys to say, go sit in a room with someone who is suicidal and struggling with PTSD, give them this mind-altering drug, and you're responsible for walking them through that over an eight-hour period. It's something that I think requires a really high level of consideration and care of how we're going to think about that. And then the second piece, the insurance piece, as I mentioned earlier, I just believe that this is something that a lot of folks are already looking to make money off of. Silicon Valley is pop in with all kinds of businesses who are trying to capitalize. And I just want to ensure that the folks who need it the most can actually afford and get access to this. So I'd be, you know, really disappointed to see, for example, this therapy costs $10,000. That will keep it out of range for so many folks who really need it. And so having a group of people come together who represent a lot of different interest groups and also have experience in this can really think critically about that licensing and that insurance piece.
Follow up. So we have other, through the chair, we have other sorts of treatments that, for example, electroconvulsive therapy, which we use with severe depression, which requires an anesthesiologist, which requires a doctor to be present to administer it, that happens in a hospital setting. So again, we didn't have a task force for that. So I feel like even if it requires additional folks to be present, I'm not sure that we need a task force to determine that. Why a task force and not the medical facility itself making those decisions?
Representative Gray, through the chair, I don't think the medical facility is able to make licensing determinations. So we have to create a new licensing infrastructure in the state to determine out of the different types of monitors, lead monitors and assistant monitors, who can be licensed. So in the same way we have boards and commissions that oversee certified direct entry midwives and barbers and massage therapists, it's going to be similar to that, where how are we going to determine what qualifies someone to administer this medicine? And so, for example, there could be a task force that comes together and says, hey, we want to keep this really tight, and we only want to allow in our state folks who are psychiatrists to be able to administer this. Other states like Oregon are, you know, they've created their entire own licensing department, and they're building from scratch a kind of a process of what it looks like to become licensed in their state to offer this. So because we're dealing with something that's so unique, it just requires something different than just being able to check a box.
Final follow-up.
Follow-up.
So the vast majority of veterans in the state of Alaska receive their care through the Alaska VA. The Alaska VA is a federal institution. We follow federal guidelines. Our pharmacy is a federal pharmacy. We follow federal guidelines. I am not sure that a state task force would have any authority over a federal facility and what it does with its patients. I'm just curious if you've explored that.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think that there are about 6 or 7 different insurance groups in our state, so VA, Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera. And so this task force will be looking at all of those different insurance groups and what they're able to do and what levers they can kind of pull or what they're even allowed to do for each of those. So you may be correct. I'm not very familiar with how the VA works, but we would still want to make sure in case that person is maybe perhaps married to someone who has a different insurance and they want to seek their care outside of the VA, that they would still have that best care and be able to afford that care. Just give them that option.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I've got a statement and then a question. Representative Armstrong, I hear you loud and clear. You're not taking a position. I've got that disclaimer here. You said it, Oriel. And I hear the interest and maybe excitement in your voice just about as you speak about this. I don't know if it's appropriate for this committee to argue the benefits of psychotropic drugs or psychedelic drugs. That's kind of beyond our mission, I think, and beyond our ken. So my question, I guess, is kind of theoretical. My question is kind of on the basis of the entire bill. It is entirely prospective. It's contingent on the FDA approving psychedelic drugs for treatment, and it directs the department to do a lot of work and a lot of preparation on a prospective. The word premature also comes to mind. It's almost like we want to buy a car and buy the floor mats and get the get the maps and everything and get ready for a trip, but we don't yet pass the driver's license test. It might be more appropriate to take this in order, pass the test, and buy the car, to wait for the FDA to take their action, and then we can spend time, resources, and effort to prepare for it. That would be my... So I guess the question is, why do so much work based on a perspective not sure to happen?
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Through the chair, the FDA has given every indication that they will be approving this drug in August, given everything that's happened over the past 20 years. The breakthrough therapy, the application granted priority review, they don't have to do that. And they usually only do that for drugs that they deem of like highest importance, which speeds up and puts them under a shorter timeline for approving that drug. So just from like large amounts of research and communication, and they put out brand new guidance last summer for clinical investigation, we see that it's highly likely. The reason we're so eager to do this proactively is because if we wait until after, it always costs more to fix something before it's broken. And it always seems smarter to be a little bit more strategic and forward thinking. And so let's say that this medicine is approved in August. I don't actually know from the moment it's approved when it would, let's say, go into production and start being available for prescription. But maybe that's the end of the year. Maybe it's immediate. we want to make sure that as soon as that's available, if we have folks who are showing up at the hospital and are like, hey, I saw that I can get MDMA now, and be like, oh, sorry, we're not licensed yet. No one in the state is licensed. We will be holding back Alaskans from being able to get that access. So if we don't think proactively about this, the state will be hurrying to try and play catch up and do this later. And like I said, I think that that's the kind of thing that can cost more time, money, more of an iterative approach. And we just like to see us be a little bit forward thinking so that the moment this happens, we're ready. And just to kind of explain the there's a lot of kind of time built in here, because first the task force will meet this year, submit a report at the end of the year, and then they would make policy recommendations that either the legislature or the administration could choose to enact. And so they're just bringing forth those recommendations for you. So by doing that by the end of this year, you would know whether that's something you just need to sit on, because maybe the FDA didn't approve the drug in August, but they approved the next one in March. And then you're ready to go, and you've got a whole stack of what needs to be done in the state to prepare for that.
Follow up. Through the chair, I just want to respectfully, again, you're speaking as if it's a sure thing. If the FDA were to pass, I hesitate to ask, it's not our area of expertise, but do you believe that psychedelic drugs would in fact be beneficial? Is that a judgment you've made or a determination you've made in your mind?
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Through the chair, I don't feel comfortable making any kind of proclamations. I just want to follow what the FDA does. I believe that they have 20 years of data from this one study, and all of it has been incredibly positive, no adverse effects, and nothing but good news for the participants who've gone through it. So I can only speak to what has come from those trials. And it does seem like it's something very hopeful. And part of our interest in doing this is that we're a state that can greatly benefit due to our high rates of mental health. Many folks in our state would qualify for this medicine potentially.
Thank you. And I'll reiterate the follow-up and conclusion. This, it may be, may not be, but I think it would be prudent to wait until it happens before we embark on the task force you're describing. Thank you.
Looks like you have one slide left. You want to go ahead and continue?
Thank you.
All right, so I do have a question for you. I do see that there's not a member on this board for pharmacy. Is that is there a reason why you didn't add them, or should they be on there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We didn't add someone for someone who's a pharmacist because it wasn't part of the task force to look into that. I would assume that however this drug is scheduled, the prior pharmaceutical methodology would just transfer over. That part seems pretty standard, but I'm very open to being wrong. And if it would be prudent to add a pharmacist or pharmaceutical representation to the board, we are open to anything.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Carpenter.
Mr. Chair, do we have the Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to answer questions?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Question I would have for the department, I guess the first one would be, what is the agency or board that currently reviews new drugs, just for my understanding?
Ms. Fallows, would you mind coming up and putting yourself on the record?
I was waiting for my voice from above.
Hello. For the record, Michaela Fowler, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And through the chair, that would be the Board of Pharmacy, who typically is working with to provide instructions out, and they issue bulletins as the FDA approves drugs. The Alaska Board of Pharmacy does not approve drugs for distribution, obviously.
Follow up.
If the action taken by the FDA requires a review or recommendations from the Board of Pharmacy to either the executive branch for regulatory change or to the legislature for statutory change, is that something that the Board of Pharmacy would normally do?
Through the chair, this is not a circumstance that we see often with this sort of caliber of change. I would anticipate that should the FDA approve these drugs, that there would likely be communication amongst many boards, including the Board of Pharmacy, the Medical Board, the Board of Psychiatrists. I believe that there would be many of our boards that would be involved in that activity. Thank you.
Representative Groh?
I have more questions for the sponsor.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Through the chair, and first of all, I want to thank and commend Representative Armstrong and your staff for bringing this bill forward. Like a number of other Alaska legislators, I represent a number of veterans, as well as I obviously represent the great majority of the residents of those who live in the state's largest military base, Joint Base Ellensburg Richardson. Representative Armstrong, could you elaborate more if there, you talked about the benefits, potential benefits for veterans of this medication or use of medication. Could you elaborate more, if you could, about potential veteran benefits for veterans in particular? Thank you.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Groh. The greatest benefit that we see is that they go into remission on PTSD. So with MDMA and the approval that would be coming in August, it is specifically for PTSD. And as you saw, 71.2% in remission. So the benefits for veterans is we have more veterans who are with us and not committing suicide. That's more kids who have their parents that are in healthier households. It also means as I mentioned, the way that this treatment works, you're doing 3 8-hour sessions with a therapist under the influence of MDMA and 12 drug-free therapy sessions. And it was after that that they went into remission. When you think about the cost of PTSD and mental health care for the VA and the burden on the system, it's enormous and it's never ending because we've never had a true kind of cure like this or something that could put it into such remission. So thinking about those antidepressants, that long-term therapy care, and I don't want to anyway state that, you know, it's magical. You do these 12 sessions and 3 rounds with MDMA and everything is good. You're likely going to need some ongoing care. But I think what we hear from so many folks is that they no longer need this really intensive care. And then also really importantly, a lot of these folks are able to go back to work. They're able to fully participate in their lives. They're able to kind of get a second chance at being able to be a full member of our society. And so I think that that is something that really can't be understated.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gray.
One more question. Thank you. Through the chair, again, thank you for bringing it forward. What I want is some reassurance. Well, I guess it's 2 questions. Number one, are you certain that there will be special licenses required for this medication that wouldn't be required for other medications?
Thank you, through the chair. The state of Alaska could just choose to have anybody who's got a PhD to do this or has a psychiatrist. But I think the reason that we want to be so thoughtful about this is that this type of therapy and working with someone under the influence of these medicines requires really specialized care. It oftentimes requires specialized training. The state of Alaska could choose to say that anyone who becomes licensed to do this kind of care actually needs to go through a 6-month or 1-year program. As I mentioned, Oregon is creating some kind of framework around that now for how they determine who does this. And that's why we want to have a task force, because it requires such great care. You can imagine with all of the positives that come, that when you have someone in that condition, if you have the wrong person conducting that therapy, and I don't mean wrong in terms of like they could have some sort of qualifications technically on paper, but if they don't meet certain criteria, you can imagine the kind of harm that could be inflicted in those situations. So no, the state doesn't need to do anything. The state could just let this roll out and let insurance companies charge whatever they want and let anybody practice this. But I think we would see greater harm as a result of that. And I do believe that even without the task force, as the deputy commissioner mentioned, several boards and lots of folks are still going to have to come together and do this work and make these decisions. We're just trying to do it proactively and with less of a burden on the state.
Representative Gray?
Yes. So through the chair, would it be fair to say that the task force would serve as a barrier so that folks wouldn't be received? Like it will slow down the rollout, because otherwise it would just be legalized and people would have access immediately. But by having this task force in place, we would set up this length of licensing requirements and such that would kind of make it more difficult to get, and that would create the barrier to make sure that people don't get it inappropriately.
Thank you, Representative Gray. Through the chair, that is the will of the task force, and that's why we want to have a task force. Should it be really easy to get? Should it be really hard? Who should qualify? Who should do it? I don't think this task force will be a barrier at all. As I mentioned, I think that this will actually speed things up. If we wait until medicalization, I believe the process will be much slower. The medicine will be there. I think you'll see people who maybe leave the state and go to other states to seek care where they're already ready to go. When the prescription is legalized, we could technically maybe write that prescription, but if we haven't licensed anyone in the state to actually carry it out, that means there will be a drug that could benefit Alaskans and no one here will have access unless we take these considerations into play.
Sorry, one last follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Through the chair. So I guess, but my understanding is if we don't have special licenses required and it becomes a new prescription medication, that anyone with a medical license who can prescribe the medication could prescribe it. So, and then it would be obviously on them whether or not they follow the FDA guidelines of how exactly to administer it within a clinical setting. But I'm just curious about the finding that not having the task force would slow down access when we have so many other drugs that get approved that we just write prescriptions for.
It may or may not, through the chair. There's so many ways that this can go. There's lots of medicines that are not just blanket prescribed. They oftentimes require referrals. For example, many doctors will not prescribe an antidepressant to you unless you have a referral from a therapist. That's not true for everyone. There's lots of different ways that's handled. And I think because this drug is so intense in the way that it works and its mechanism, that we want to be really thoughtful about who we're allowing to do this. So I don't think that any doctor should just be able to prescribe. I think that we should thoroughly vet who the right person is for this based on the FDA guidance, who should receive this medicine. You need to go through screenings. It's not as easy as just showing up and saying, I have PTSD. I want to take MDMA. There's a lot of steps, and it's just more involved than other drugs that are on the market is basically what it comes down to. This is something that's much more involved, requires a lot more care and thoughtfulness.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
So I want to go back to my other train of thinking, Mr. Chair. Can the appropriate boards, since there may be many of them, come together already to have a joint meeting? Is there statutory authority for them to get together and have a discussion that doesn't require a larger expense to the state? There's already going to be an expense for those boards to come and meet, but can they already come together? Do they have the statutory authority to do that for this purpose? Maybe for the department?
For the record, Michaela Fowler, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Commerce. Yes, the boards absolutely can come together under current statutory authorities to have cross-professional discussions.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, and maybe this is for the bill sponsor, we're discussing if the intent here is to identify subject matter experts in the application of new prescription drug, and those would be limited to people who have been properly trained and are following the FDA guidelines or whatever comes out through the FDA process. Wouldn't either a task force or a group of boards coming together to look at the recommendations for the state require the FDA guidelines in order to make decisions or fully understand what it is that we have to put in place? I mean, without the guidelines being published, what do we have to talk about?
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. Through the chair, we have non-binding guidelines from the FDA from last summer. As I mentioned, we have 20 years plus of clinical trial data, and so we have lots and lots of data about what needs to be considered in terms of the licensing, and the FDA has given us a lot of guidance on that. And just like with other drugs, there's a lot that's left up to the states to determine what they're going to want to do with it. On the context of the boards being able to come together, they absolutely can. As you'll see in our task force, we have representatives from the Alaska Native Health Board, a licensed therapist who is, you know, brought forward from an addiction specialist. We have different stakeholder groups that we want to make sure are represented, because that is a really key part of the licensing piece and thinking about that. So culture-informed care is something that is really important and I think historically gets left out. And without that, sometimes you can see that you're actually perpetuating the harms that you're trying to fix when you aren't being thoughtful about who is facilitating that care. And so that'll be something for the task force to think about. And it's why it was important for us to have a really well-rounded group of folks who came together to think about that. And I did, if it's okay, Chair Wright, through the chair, one note on the fiscal note in front of you was from the original version of the bill, not the committee substitute. We made several changes, including a drafting error that had this going through 2027. This task force would be dissolved by the end of this year. We removed all travel costs and in-person fees, and we don't believe there needs to be a printing of this report. It can be distributed digitally. There's a number of factors, so I think we really look forward to getting an updated fiscal note once the department has seen the committee substitute.
Follow up, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. Through the chair, this might be a question for both of you. For the sponsor, you'd talked about businesses that have already cropped up in other states who have are leaning forward in this area. And I guess the question would be, what exactly does that mean from the research that you've done? And then to the administration, has there been anybody that has identified or self-identified that they would like to establish a business in relation to this anticipated FDA? I mean, in my mind, I'm thinking an 8-hour psychedelic guided vacation for the clinically depressed. I mean, that's kind of in a nutshell what I hear is a business idea. And that seems like a brand new world. Like, we don't have that right now. So what's going on?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Carpenter, through the chair. Some of the companies that we're seeing that are cropping up are really looking at the creation of new medicine, so kind of patented compounds of psilocybin, MDMA, and other compounds. We've seen lots of municipalities, Denver, Oakland, others who have decriminalized these medicines. And so you're seeing a lot of therapists who've been working underground coming above ground to offer different types of integration services. So the part that comes after taking the psychedelics is just as important. In Oregon, as I said, Oregon is the only state that has legalized this ahead of FDA approval. So they're our best ones to look at. They're kind of the guinea pig because they're having to create from scratch a licensing framework. And to your point, just as we've seen clinics pop up, I know I'm getting advertisements in Anchorage for ketamine therapy. I think you're going to see more folks in maybe perhaps creating specialized clinics or expanding their services to be able to offer this. And I think we might hear from some folks in testimony today who can probably speak to that better than I can.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions from the committee? All right. Looks like we do have some invited testimony. Let's see here. Ms. Beth Law, are you on the line?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Awesome. Will you state your name and your affiliation? Put yourself on the record.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. My name is Beth Law. I am a retired colonel. I live in Wasilla, Alaska. I spent 34 years in the service. I spent 14 years on active duty here in Alaska. I was the recruiting and retention commander at one point. So I'm completely familiar with Alaska and all of it, all of that. Anyway, I'd like to give you a brief, background. I survived alcoholic parents, sexual assaults, rape. I was held for 3 days. The same guy tried to kill me. I know a lot of this sounds really intense, but I want you to understand where I'm coming from or where I came from. And I was deployed to Operation Iraqi Freedom. I'm a combat veteran. In 2009, I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and given 2 years to live. I was medically separated from the Army. And during my time, still since 2009, I was my sister's caregiver who died of cancer. In 2012, I was my father's caregiver who died of cancer. In 2014 and in 2015, I was a caregiver for a very close friend who subsequently passed. I spend every year going up and down on a roller coaster, waiting for my results to come back, because it's not a matter of when it's not a matter of if it will, it's a matter of when it will. So this is what I've been told from all my stuff. I've experienced years of I've been on antidepressants. I've been on mood stabilizers for my combat experience, and for anxiety and depression. I also spent a little bit over 2 years monthly therapies at the Combat Veteran Center in Wasilla, Alaska. Awesome, awesome facility. I am your person who has direct firsthand knowledge of going through psilocybin. I found a retreat in Jamaica, which is called Myco Meditations, M-Y-C-O Meditations. They have a facility there where I went in December. There's you have three different you have an initial session with a group therapy, and then you have three different doses, and your set and setting. I heard a lot of that earlier today. Your set and setting is extremely important. And when you go through the screening process, they do not take bipolar individuals or narcissists. Those are the two people who this has a lot to do with your subconscious and your conscious mind. And so those two people are not good candidates for this. So again, I went for 1 week. I did three different doses of psilocybin mushrooms. There was a therapist and a facilitator with me at all times. The dosing lasts about 5.5, maybe 6 hours if you're on a higher dose. Somebody else who has a lot more experience can tell that. I'm just telling you about my firsthand knowledge. And after every dose, then you go through an integration period where they actually discuss what it is that you've seen and or felt and or experienced, and how it can make sense into your brain. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, which we can talk about that if you have more questions for me. Again, with the integration sessions, and it's not an easy thing to do. It's extremely difficult. It's not a go out into get on the beach and go get high and run naked through the ocean. It's not anything like that. It's not like MDMA, go home and experience it. It is a very structured setting where there is a doctor that administers it. There's a nurse there that is actually with everybody. The only thing that anybody ever experienced that I know of was a little bit of sickness opposed to what they call bad trips. Anyway, I'll let that part go. Let's see. Like I said, it's not something for the faint of heart. What it helped me do is my fear of dying after I came back from Jamaica basically just vanished out of my head. I still know that I have cancer. I still know that I have to go get tested, and I still know that I have all of those other things. However, it is not something that I constantly think about. And if there is any way that Alaska could help my brothers and sisters not kill themselves because of this particular drug, I can't say enough good things about it. I can't tell you how much it helped me with all of the trauma that I went through. And I think that's I know people who have had experience with MDMA and ketamine and also psilocybin, and they far outweigh the psilocybin for therapeutic purposes, which is that's what this is for. It's not a drug, and anybody can have it. And people shouldn't just have it to just go and take it and figure out what's going on with themselves. It definitely has to be somebody who's well-trained and experienced with that particular type of a drug. So that's, I don't know what else I can tell you. If you have any questions, I'm here.
Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Law, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Looks like we do have one more invited testimony, Mr. DeMolini, Molina.
Hi, my name's Dr. Michael DeMolina. I live here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I have been taking notes of this very excellent discussion, and I do have some responses for some of the very specific questions that were asked. I thank Representative Armstrong for inviting me, and also just want to say you have an incredible mastery of the data. I really appreciate that. I am a 35-year Alaskan. I went to the Academy of Health Sciences in 1988 and was trained as a behavioral science specialist. And when I got to Fort Rich in 1988 through 1992, I treated active duty Vietnam soldiers as part of the drug and alcohol program at Fort Richardson at a very young age. And I've been treating Vietnam era, and then I myself in Desert Storm era, and of course, Afghanistan. I'm the president and founder of an outpatient clinic here. I got my GI Bill, I got my doctoral degree, and I've been serving veterans for 35 years here. And I'm a national trainer in trauma-informed care using eye movement desensitization, brain spotting, EFT tapping, and other trauma-informed care systems, which have raised the success rate in treating veterans from about the 42% percentile of success, and success is being defined as the cessation of the symptoms of PTSD. So there's a line of what success means. And the trauma-informed systems raised that success rate up into the 60s, and I think that's great. And the 72% mark that 24 years of these trials through the FDA is remarkable. It's just remarkable to see. And so as a 35-year drug and alcohol counselor, this is not any conversation I thought I would ever be advocating for. I really have to be honest with everyone. And yet the successes that I've seen and I've been able to facilitate with my clients and patients as a therapist have been remarkable. And I have a list of notes I've taken over the last hour, but I'm open for any kind of questions from anyone here.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. And through the chair, Doctor, maybe you can give me a high-level understanding of what this medication is actually doing. It sounds like if the ingestion of the medication induces some response to the body, but yet that response has to require additional personnel for a length of time, is this a situation where the medication is actually rewiring or altering the pathways in the brain over time that is a final solution to some problem? Or is it something that you have to have continual treatment to maintain?
Thank you for that question. And I hope I don't bore everyone with neuroscience with my answer. So what we call trauma-informed care actually does provide what's called, through the American Psychological Association, there's a rubric called exposure therapy. And all of the different methods of exposure therapy do exactly as you just said. It rewires the brain, the amygdala, the part of the brain that's in charge of that fear response, and the vagus nerve, which is a nerve that goes from the brain to the gut. There is a rewiring. And hopefully that's enough there, that there are many ways of doing it. But what psychedelic-assisted therapy does is take a one-year or two-year process in which we can have some success and reduces it to 3 months and get a higher level, a 10% higher level of success by activating the same neural pathways in the brain. Specifically, there's a part of the brain called the default mode network. The default mode network is the part of the brain that basically is the part of our brain that tells us our stories. It's the narrative part of our brain. So the dosage session itself kind of neutralizes the default mode network just temporarily enough where people can come back to their own embodied experience of trauma and tell a different story. And many of the points that have been made in the last hour is how important the therapeutic aspect of it is. And that's going to be the big thing that's going to need education across the nation, is it's not about the medicine itself. The difference here is that a psychedelic-assisted therapy with a emphasis on the word therapy, the therapist has to be involved in what's called preparation sessions, educating the patient what to expect during the medicine session, and then doing integration sessions. And so and this has been the 20 years of research, is what is the right dosage, if you will, what's the right pattern of the therapy. And it's all written out there in the MAPS website for free for everybody. It's a medical clearance, and Colonel Law actually was correct. You know, bipolar 1, schizophrenia, narcissism, there's a couple of rule outs, which I might want to highlight is the reason we don't just want it out on the streets altogether. It would be why I would advocate for this bill, because there is a different kind of medicine occurring than what we have been used to in the past. So again, there's a medical clearance, and then there's two preparations, and then there's a dosage, and then there's another three integration sessions that assist the patient in order to retell that story while the default mode network is neutralized, to be able to come to that rewiring that you just asked about in your question. I hopefully that was a helpful answer, and I'll take more questions if anyone has any.
Thank you for the answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. D. Molina. We will now move on to public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to publicly testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online? Looks like we have a few here. Sarah, are you on the line?
Yes, are you able?
Yes, would you state your name and your affiliation, put yourself on the record.
Oh, great. My name is Sarah Koza, but I'm calling in from Anchorage, Alaska. I am president-elect of the APRN Alliance. We are a group that works on policy and regulatory issues around advanced practice nursing in Alaska, where we are independently licensed. Our organization already works regularly with the Alaska Board of Nursing on regulatory concerns. I am a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner and owner of a small group practice in Anchorage, where I do care for patients with TRICARE and VA insurance. I primarily work with adults with mood and anxiety disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorder. I have completed a year-long psychedelic-assisted therapy program, as well as completed the highest level of training currently available outside of research settings through MAPS to work with MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder when this medicine becomes FDA approved. I am calling in today to support the passage of HB 228, establishing a psychedelic task force. My drive to obtain the additional training necessary to provide psychedelic-assisted therapy was because my current tools and mental health are really inadequate, leaving many of the patients on my colleagues' caseloads functioning but suffering. You know, this is the individual therapy, the Prozac, which can be helpful some of the time. But I have really always wanted more for my patients, and bringing in the psychedelic framework has really been a game changer for my patients. I currently work with ketamine, which I would call our only federally legal psychedelic adjacent medicine currently available in clinical practice. Do not work with anything that isn't federally approved. And I use this as an off-label treatment for acute suicidality, treatment-resistant depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't think it's controversial to say that Alaskans and veterans have many unmet mental health needs, and the ongoing research on psychedelic medicines show a promising ability to meet this need. However, the nature of this care really requires a multidisciplinary team. You know, there are sessions lasting up to 8 hours, requiring multiple caregivers. And I would say these this approach, these medicines actually make my patients incredibly vulnerable, which is why we need to think about who is, within whose scope is it to actually prescribe and hold space for these patients, you know, take care of that set and setting that have already been mentioned today. Advanced practice nurses will play a role in both prescribing and administering the therapy for these medications. And I believe collaboration among those represented on the task force is our best chance for creating both an accessible and ethical system of care for psychedelics. It would really be amazing if our state were ready when these medicines inevitably become available. Thank you for hearing me, and I'm very happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Gray.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for testifying. You mentioned that you took a year-long psychedelic course, and I'm curious if you believe that a year-long course would be necessary to achieve the licensure to be able to prescribe this medication.
I believe it can be done in less than a year, but so I have my doctorate in nursing, right, which is above my bachelor's. That's an additional 4 years, and I believe that additional training is necessary. The psychedelic framework is very specific to me, really to address the increased vulnerability of these patients. For example, in traditional therapy, we never touch our patients, right? And here we are putting people in an altered state of consciousness, and now they are incredibly vulnerable both to suggestion as well as to being in a space where they may need physical touch to support them through that experience. So that, in my mind, actually does require additional training above and beyond you know, what it requires me to enter into practice. I would also say it requires ongoing ethical consultation and community in order to kind of manage the way these medicines shape the therapeutic relationship.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Kuzup. We also have Bailey Stewart on the line. Bailey, can you hear me?
I can, Chair.
Oh, perfect.
My name is Bailey Stewart. I speak on behalf of Stewart Consulting. Good afternoon, Chair Wright and House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee members.
I'm a professor at UAA,
educating students on the subject of cannabis science and regulation. And I also serve on the board of Limitless Advance, a nonprofit that works with veterans and active duty members through jiu-jitsu. I come to you today in support of House Bill 228. Given the experience I have in a Schedule 1 substance, I do believe it is in the best interest of the state of Alaska and for our veterans to begin holding these conversations. In January, the Department of Veterans Affairs issued a request for proposals to study the use of certain psychedelic compounds in treating post-traumatic stress disorders and depression. This is the first time since the 1960s that the VA is funding research on these compounds. I believe it is important to public health and safety of our veterans and residents that we begin having these discussions about what takes place following FDA approval of psychedelics as medicine and what it could possibly look like to the state of Alaska before this event takes place, and to discuss the framework on how these substances will be regulated. While these substances can be of great use to medicine and facilitating the mental health of our veterans, I do believe it is important that the substances have anticipated regulatory framework before FDA approval. Having experienced marijuana legalization in this great state before having regulations in place, I saw firsthand the confusion it brought with the public at large. While legalization and FDA approval are two different things, I do believe it is important to prevent confusion with practitioners upon FDA approval and provide anticipated framework for providers to include in their practices. The future of medicine, particularly in the mental health sector, is going in the direction of assisted psychedelic therapy. I do believe this bill outlines appropriate members to be a part of the task force and could be vital to the addressing the mental health crisis that the state of Alaska and our veterans are experiencing. As an advocate for a regulatory framework to protect our residents, I ask that you support House Bill 228 and let the state of Alaska begin preparing for the future of psychedelic medicine being used as a tool to address the mental health of our veterans and residents by preparing for anticipated psychedelic medicine use in a manner that keeps public health and safety in mind. Thank you, Chair Wright, and members of the House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee for your time and for taking my public testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. Is there any questions? We also have Kathleen Wiedmeyer.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members.
Kathleen?
Yes. Yes. I am Kathleen Wiedmeyer with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, a psychiatric watchdog group. While version Y of HB 228 clarifies that the state of Alaska will not make legal or deliver psychedelic drugs without fully FDA approval, which is an improvement, our position is other on this bill. We urge caution in planning the setup of a system of mental health treatment that trades one brain resetting drug for another, particularly in light of recent studies that have found little to no evidence supporting the chemical imbalance in the brain theory of depression and mental illness. And I'm going to quote here, "There is now unequivocal evidence of the failures of a system that relies too heavily on the biomedical model of mental health services, including the frontline and excessive use of psychotropic medicines, and yet these models persist," unquote. And that is the former UN Special Rapporteur, Dr. Danius Pierce. Psychedelics are unpredictable by nature. They behave differently for each person and can have long-term damaging or harmful side effects. Forensic psychiatrist Brian Haloyden stated in the Oregonian, "There remains insufficient evidence regarding the safety of psilocybin, however. In addition, clinical trials have been extremely exclusionary in selecting participants, so there is little data on the effect of psilocybin in real-world populations of patients with psychiatric disorders," unquote. As the legislature seeks solutions for very real and urgent mental health problems, we would ask they investigate other avenues, such as the ones detailed in the World Health Organization's guidance on community mental health services and in their most recent mental health human rights and legislation guidance and practice. Thank you.
We do have a question for Ms. Stewart. Sure. Ms. Wiedmeyer, you mind staying on the line?
I don't mind.
Thank you. Ms. Stewart, are you there?
I am.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And honestly, I don't know who would be best to answer this, so I would just pose the question and maybe the appropriate person will sort themselves out. So we have a problem with prescription drug abuse in the country right now. And what I'm hearing is this is a significantly different type of drug than maybe what we're used to as far as mental health is concerned. Is the evidence pointing to right now that this is or is not a potentially addictive drug, or is it a possibility that we're trading one sort of addiction for another, and how we control the drug from getting out and being abused is something that does concern me.
Thank you, Representative Carpenter. If it's okay, Representative Wright, I'd be happy to take an answer at this.
Please do.
There's a chart that I can, through the chair, there's a chart I can provide to the committee that shows addictive, a range of addictiveness of a variety of drugs. So you can imagine at the highest end, we're looking at alcohol and nicotine. Psychedelics are on the absolute lowest end. There has been nothing to show that, or very, in any of these trials, there's been nothing to show that it's addictive. And then the second thing, it's a great question you brought up about, like, will this get out? The way that this works is you are not being prescribed this medicine and then going home with it. That medicine is only being given to you. You are watched while you ingest it on site. There's no ability for you to kind of take that home. I think an interesting thing that the task force would be able to look into is I know that, I'm sorry, I don't know the exact terminology, but basically doctor shopping or hopping and doing all of that is something that's common. You did kind of mention this as a vacation. I think for most folks, it's not an 8-hour vacation. It's probably like going through hell because you're just reliving all of your trauma over 8 hours and trying to reprogram your brain. But I don't think it's something in that case that a lot of people are going to want to do over and over again unless it was really necessary. I think as we've seen, the majority of folks only need that one course of treatment, but perhaps the task force can look into how do we ensure folks aren't just going, you know, from one doctor to the next, you know, seeking to have these experiences. I hope that answers part of your question. I'd be happy to hear from any testifiers to clarify.
A response, Mr.
Hi. I couldn't speak to the addictiveness of it, but I will say that there is.
Please put your name on the record, please.
I'm sorry. This is Kathleen Wiedemeyer with the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. In the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, there is now a hallucinogen persisting perception disorder that is considered to be a very real psychiatric condition as a result of the use of hallucinogenic drugs. So I don't know about the addictiveness of it, but there can be some pretty severe and long-term side effects from it. And that's all I'll say.
I guess just to follow up to the comments, I appreciate the answer and definitely bears more thinking. In my mind, we started with legalization of an illegal drug in the context of marijuana. And there was a few ways in which we had access to that, how we ingested it, if you will. And now, I mean, we've got a plethora of ways, gummies that kids could easily get their hands on. I'm not suggesting that this is the direction we're going. I just, it concerns me that something that would be popular with society, with such strong impact that someone needs to be under physical care for 8 hours, could be abused by the public, and that is concerning to me.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think Dr. Daya Mina, hopefully I pronounced his name correctly, was spot on in saying that this is something where, again, and to Representative Gray's questions earlier, you're helping me make the argument for the task force and why it is so important that we come up with the structures in place of what kind of medical screening and how much prep and at what point, what is the threshold at which the state of Alaska will determine that a person is ready to go through this very, very intense life-altering experience. And so these are all great questions that the state will have to answer. I am afraid that if we don't answer them in the context of a task force, and this is why so many states are establishing these types of task forces, that there could be mistakes that are made or things that slip through the cracks or things we don't know because we didn't proactively bring those experts. And I wanted to thank Nurse Sarah for coming because she is representative of so many Alaskans we've heard from who have proactively on their own time and with their own money gone ahead and gotten this extra training that is required. They themselves, our own medical professionals, are preparing themselves for this. And I think that we owe it to them to make sure that we're putting just as much thoughtfulness and preparation into the potential legalization of these prescription drugs.
Hi, this is Michael DeMolina. Is it okay if I respond?
Yes, Michael.
Yeah, I'm also MAPS trained and went through a one-year program of preparation as well. I'll be graduating here in another month or two. And the reason that I went ahead and I invested a lot of time and resources into this is because of the inevitability of, frankly, whatever our attitudes are to it, it's coming. And I know that there's, you know, some question about whether or not the FDA is going to reschedule this or not. But I think it is, I believe it's inevitable. And the other inevitability is that I have emergency medical calls coming into my clinic with people who are flying to Mexico and flying outside of the country. Who are doing this anyway, and we are having to respond to people where there's no quality control, and there's not the kind of integration, and there's not the kind of therapy, and there's not the kind of wraparound service that this committee would actually assist in creating for our state. And so, again, my full-throated support behind having standards for how this kind of therapy is going to be rolled out.
Thank you. Representative Gray?
Thank you. Through the chair, I have two questions for Kathleen Wiedemeyer, if she's still on the line.
Kathleen, are you still on the line?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Wiedemeyer, can you please explain the relationship between the Citizens Commission of Human Rights and the Church of Scientology?
We are sponsored by the Church of Scientology. In 1969, the Church of Scientology and Dr. Thomas Foss, who was then with the, he's a psychiatrist. He was the professor emeritus of psychiatry at Syracuse University. Together, they founded the Citizens Commission on Human Rights because Dr. Foss was appalled at the conditions that he saw, and so was the Church of Scientology. So we are sponsored by the Church of Scientology. That's basically it. We're sponsored by the Church of Scientology. We're not an arm of it. We're not part of it. We're not a branch of it. But we do have a sponsorship relationship.
Follow up.
Thank you. Second question is, what is the Citizens Commission on Human Rights position on the use of traditional antidepressants, SSRIs, such as Prozac or Zoloft?
We're not big fans of the use of chemicals simply because, and here is our position pretty exactly. We feel that before a person is given a diagnosis and a prescription, they should be given a searching physical examination to rule out any physical causes of their depression. There are many physical conditions, the symptoms of which mimic psychiatric conditions. That is rarely done. And we also feel that if a person is recommended an antidepressant, et cetera, they should be given full disclosure as to the potential side effects. And that is rarely done. That is our position.
Thank you, Chair.
Are there any other questions for the bill sponsor? Like to close public testimony at this moment. Seeing no further questions, I will set an amendment deadline for HB 228 on Monday, February 18th at noon, and we will hold HB 228 over until a further future meeting. That concludes the agenda for today. If there is no other business, the House Special Committee on Military Veterans Affairs adjourn at 2:29 p.m.